We have our three pilot presenters here, and Mark is going to be our expert today on the F4UF Corsair behind him. And first of all, Mark, tell us how you got into the Warbirds and when you started.
Okay. So thank you all for coming. I really appreciate you taking your time out of your busy schedule. This is about my 20th time at Oshkosh, so it's an honor to be here. And I know it's hot, so if it makes you feel any better, people ask us what it's like to fly one of these airplanes. Imagine putting on your winter coat on a day like today, get in your car, and instead of starting it and turning on the air conditioner, you turn the heat on. That's about what it feels like. But anyway, how I got started in this, my father's here in the crowd. I grew up on a 4,000-foot grass strip, started out in the Piper Cub when I was 16, moved up to a Stearman and a T-6, a P-51, and then started working for a few museums and got the opportunity to fly 11 different types of warbirds, and then went on to become an instructor teaching other people to fly the P-51 and the Corsair. So that's where I got my start.
Tell us a little bit about the specs on this, the Corsair, please.
Charlie, go ahead. This one's his department.
That's a subtle handoff. And we are greatly honored to be able to present this plane today. And thank you very much to John and Dan Mosley and their crew at John's 360 Coatings, who not only painted this magnificent airplane, but their products help us keep it clean with a little bit of elbow grease. There were over 12,000 of these airplanes built, and I think the great history of this wasn't just a World War II plane. This was designed in the early part of the war and wound up finishing through Korea. So of those, you had airplanes built by Chance Vaught in Connecticut, you had Brewster Aircraft and Goodyear, who actually built the most of them. And the number in various models, this is a Dash 4, which is a later model airplane. The difference between the early birdcage one, where people like our great friend Jim Tobel has a chance to fly, to this, it is night and day. It's just the difference is incredible. So we're fortunate to do this. OBE's presentation, for us to be able to fly a plane like this, and thanks to Steve Chappis, our good friend who introduced us to OBE, and to have the honor of flying a combat veteran with the history and still having the pilot today alive, Sam, is just a true pleasure, because as you pointed out, most of the Corsairs, the one we fly the most was a racing airplane. If you ask somebody the specs of a Corsair, it's sort of happy to tell you which model.
how big an engine is this with that one?
Well, and Sam, so that's one of those things that this was the real difference maker compared to like the Zero that Mark and I get to fly. This was a beast. This is a 2,000 horsepower engine built by Pratt & Whitney, 2,800. And again, being Northeast guys, we have a little bit of pride because the plane was designed in Connecticut and originally built in Connecticut, but so too was the engine built by Pratt & Whitney up in Hartford and Hartzell propeller. So big, big engine.
Now, the propeller has a lot to do with the design of the wing. Is that correct?
Very much so. So they had such a big engine with so much horsepower, the only way you can convert that engine power to thrust was this giant 13-plus inch or foot propeller. And to land it on a carrier, to have this clearance with this big prop, the landing gear would have to be massive, and of course it becomes a weak point and a point of potential failure. So some very genius people with slide rules, or forget computers and all that, figured out, you know, if we just bend the wings, the gear can be shorter and stouter and take the punishment that you see with carrier landings. That's why we have the gull wing.
And one of the things about the armament, not a lot of people have been able to fly a Corsair with all the rockets and the drop tanks on it. And so a little quick story, when I went to pick up this airplane, Charlie went with me, and it came with all the rockets, the drop tank, but they were all in a corner, and we were deciding, okay, how are we going to get these moved? And we were going to box them all up, but then we got thinking, okay, this is going to be a pretty big box, so let's just hang it all back on the airplane the way it's supposed to be, and we'll take it with us. Well, we had no idea how much drag and weight that adds to the airplane. So I couldn't imagine, we fly it clean today and light, I couldn't imagine taking off on an aircraft carrier with full drop tanks, full rockets, full of fuel, and full of ammunition. It really had to probably be a big struggle because it's such a dynamic difference. It probably slows the airplane down 30 knots with all that drag.
Tell us the mission for it could be the air to ground or escort. It could be a number of missions, but a typical mission on this airplane flying off the carrier.
You know, it really depends. Are you talking early in the war or later in the war? One of the things that we really enjoy and it's such a privilege and honor is to be able to fly both a Japanese Zero as well as the Corsair. And I'll tell you, at some of the air shows down in a confined environment, sort of slow speed, that Zero will eat the Corsair's lunch every single time. It is a kite with a great big engine.
Well, I'm the pilot flying the Zero,
okay,
too.
So when he's flying,
give me a little credit.
The Zero is a better airplane. But with that said, as soon as we go somewhere, and we've heard pilots will sometimes play around as they're traveling places we never
do.
We
don't do that, of course.
But once you get above 200 knots, that stick in that Zero, it's like it's in concrete. Yeah. This plane will start an aerobatic routine at 310, 320 knots. You do that and pull back, and you just finger pressure all day long on the stick. So whether it's slow speed coming into a short grass field or, you know, high-speed aerobatics, it's a delight to fly.
Well, speaking of the Zero, what's the kill ratio between this airplane and the Zero?
Well, not necessarily the Zero, but the number I know that overall it's about 11 to 1.
That's what I heard also.
It was designed as a Zero killer.
Actually, it killed more. It was 11 to 1 for that. It was 10 to 1 overall. So
overall,
it actually did better on the Zero.
In all fairness, you know, one of the things is we look at the aircraft and how tremendous they are, but a lot of the unsung heroes was the training program that we had going versus what the Japanese and the Germans had. We were producing consistently well-trained, qualified pilots using a lot of the combat veterans coming back to share their experiences. The German and Japanese, you flew until you were wounded beyond ability to fly or dead. And so I think we had that long-term vision that helped us win the war in addition to fantastic aircraft.
Now, the airplane was designed to operate off the carrier, correct, from the start?
Right. From the start.
Why did the Marines end up with it first and they weren't flying off the carrier?
The Marines will tell you because they were better pilots. I'm not a Marine. Respect them. The reality is, as much as the engineering was genius on the landing gear, there was a rebound, if you will, challenge with the landing gear itself. And so you could get some pretty substantial bounces. So they learned, they improved the gear. The British were operating them off aircraft carriers, and I think there's some new information now saying that Americans were also operating them before than we think they were. But the common belief is that the Marines were operating off fixed land bases first. Mm-hmm. It's a sweetheart. It's a big, heavy airplane, but it handles well slow and low and dirty. It's the perfect sort of rough field aircraft.
Speaking of weight, would they operate this thing in combat weight-wise?
Well, it's about 12,500, but I was going to go back to the landing characteristics on this. One of the unique characteristics about this is every once in a while, you know, in a crosswind or whatever, you might have one strut collapse before the other, so the airplane will sit a little crooked even though you're traveling straight ahead. And most pilots, you want to compensate and turn the aircraft, but you can't. You have to just trust that the locked tailwheel is taking you straight down the runway. You might put a little bit of aileron in, and then eventually it'll collapse on you. But, you know, that if you try, sometimes if you try to overcorrect with this aircraft, it'll get away from you on takeoff or on landing.
Well, now you compared the Zero to it. How about other like aircraft, like the 51 or whatever?
So Charlie and I...
Not against each other, but the flying characteristics.
We fly most of our time as Corsair and Mustang. We've got a lot of time in both. But as far as characteristics, they both fly pretty similar, except the Corsair is heavier. And the Mustang is obviously faster. So when we're out flying, I got to ask them to slow down because I can't keep up with you.
In the cockpit, I think the comparison is the Corsair is the muscle car of the airplanes.
Yes, that's a good comparison.
The Mustang is very refined, the Cadillac. The only thing is when it's hot, like Mark was mentioning earlier, the Corsair, you can open the canopy.
Now, let's jump over the 51 here for a little bit. How about the specifications on it? Are you the expert? Who's the expert?
I'm not an expert in anything.
He's the expert flying it. No, few people fly it better. The amazing story, and again, this is the American ingenuity and the industry stepping up to, you know, produce what we needed at the time. From the time that North American had that contract in hand to a first flying prototype was 102 days. You would never see that now. Airplanes are a little more complicated. But it was North American team went back, and even in Washington, the night that they had those specs in hands, they went in and came up with the preliminary design, and then 102 days later, they had a flying prototype.
Now, the British got the airplane first, right, with the Allison
That's
engine?
Correct. Yep.
Well, tell about the conversion for the Allison to the Rolls-Royce.
The Allison down low was fine, but in Europe, the battle and Pacific, the battles were up high. So you needed a good turbocharged engine that operated 30, 40,000 feet. And it was the British who married the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine with this airframe and produced probably one of the best aircraft of the war, if not the best all-around combat, you know, fighter.
And then Packard, they started building the Merlin engine
right.
for ours.
So it was licensed, built to Packard. So all of the engines that you see these days were actually American-built.